Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, July 17, 2019. Opposition and military leaders sign a power-sharing deal in Sudan after lengthy negotiations.
But the people of the Sudan have reached this historic moment, the transitional military council, and of course, the revolutionary youth, intellectuals, pioneers who have taken to the streets. God bless the Sudan and God bless Africa.
And a Sudan expert says it's too early to celebrate.
We are talking about a political agreement that is going to specify the institutions of the transition and their functions. We have an important institution that is not there, that is the Constitutional Council.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. After months of talks, Sudan's military and opposition leaders have signed a power-sharing deal that rotates the control of a sovereign council for a little over 3 years. The African Union's special envoy to Sudan calls the deal historic and a great achievement towards forming a civilian-led government in the country. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Under the deal, the 11 members of the Sovereign Council, the top level of government, will be made up of 5 civilians, 5 military officials, and an 11th civilian to be elected by the 10 members. Abdul Fattah al-Burhan, the head of the Transitional Military Council, will head the council for a period of 21 months. A representative of the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition will head the council for next 18 months. The transitional government will last for 39 months before a regular government is formed. The agreement stipulates that a council of ministers, which shall not exceed 20 ministers, shall be appointed by a civilian prime minister. It also states that a legislative body will be formed within 3 months of the beginning of the transitional period. Speaking in Arabic, the African Union's special envoy to Sudan, Muhammad Hassan Labat, said after the signing ceremony that the deal paves the way for the parties to work out the details of the constitutional agreement, which is expected to specify the division of powers.
This agreement opens a new era and eases the ground for the next level, and the parties shall be able to revise and amend the constitutional declaration before the transitional period.
An emotional Mahmoud Direr, the Ethiopian envoy to Sudan, who helped mediate the deal, shed tears after ceremony, describing how the Sudanese people have been waiting patiently to see the fruits of their revolution.
It is a great moment that the people of the Sudan have reached this historic moment. The gallant army of the Sudan, the Transitional Military Council, and of course, the revolutionary youth, intellectuals, pioneers who have taken to the streets. God bless the Sudan and God bless Africa.
Speaking in Arabic, Mohammed Hamdan Himeti, the deputy head of the Transitional Military Council, who signed the agreement on behalf of the military junta, also praised the protesters for demanding change in Sudan.
This agreement is a fruit of efforts of all Sudanese people who have waited for so long to witness, which shall bring them freedom, peace, and justice. I salute all martyrs of the December Revolution. I salute all their mothers and all Sudanese women and youth.
The deal states a commission of inquiry will be created to investigate the deaths of protesters. 26-year-old Umaima Farouk, a third-year student of engineering at the Sudan University, says this day means a lot to her and millions of other Sudanese youth.
It is a big day for Sudanese people, especially the youth. It is my priority this day to be here and witness this historical day, because it means a lot to me and to the people of Sudan.
The AU's special envoy say the parties will hold more talks on Friday to discuss the roles and responsibilities of the Sovereign Council and the Council of Ministers, which includes the appointments of head of judiciary, the Chief Justice, and the state governors. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Sudan's political agreement has been met with skepticism by one Sudan expert who says there are lots of sticking points not addressed in the agreement. Omar Ismail, senior advisor at the Washington-based Enough Project, points out what is missing from the agreement.
The stipulations are definitely covering some of the issues that are important when you are trying to build a country through the transitional period. However, there are a few more details that are necessary, and they were not part of the agreement. But we hope that all the discrepancies and the missing parts on the power sharing agreement.
What are those missing parts? What are the sticking points that you're talking about right now?
For example, if we are talking about a political agreement that is going to specify the institutions of the transition and their functions, we have an important institution that is not there. That is the Constitutional Council or the legislative body is not there. It was postponed for 90 days. And instead of talking about that and talking about it as an important institution, they are actually spelling, and this is something that I don't see a lot in agreements of such importance, that they are spelling out the reservations. The FFC was saying the freedom, the forces of freedom and change were saying, we reserve the right to keep our power sharing, our share of the Constitutional Assembly to 67% according to our previous agreements with the TMC. And the TMC is saying, we reserve the right to say that we don't agree with you. I mean, this is not a way of looking at things to go forward, especially when come to talk about an institution that is so important like this. You have the Sovereign Council, they agreed on more or less. You have the Cabinet or the Council of Ministers, and the third an institution that is going to complement these institutions is the Constituent Assembly. Nobody is talking about it, and in fact, when they are talking about it, they are talking about it in a negative term. So I think this is showing us that we have a lot of battles that are coming ahead of us in the future.
Including the signing of the constitutional agreement.
Yeah, the signing of the constitutional agreement is not going to be easy, because everybody who is looking at the political document today, and like myself, seeing that there are things that are omitted, or you know, deliberately, or just, you know, and also looking at the wording of the document. I don't know if you looked at it in English, but I looked at both versions, in Arabic and in English, the original, of course, the Arabic version, and there were some discrepancies and a little bit of inadequacy in terms of, you know, what specific words would mean in terms of legal frameworks like this that is going to be the you know, the governing body for the future of the transition of 3+ years.
So it's safe to say that you're skeptical about the political agreement. What have your sources in the diaspora been telling you?
Some of them, you know, for example, you know, all it starts at home. I talked to my younger sister in Khartoum today, and she said to me, any agreement that is keeping the life flowing, you know, and, as normally as possible, is a good agreement. So that is one perspective. Talk to my political friends, and they're absolutely frustrated, and they are saying that the forces of freedom and change are doing the best that they can, but this is not the best for all of us in Sudan. And to some people, looking at the symbolism of Hemeti signing on behalf of General Hamdan Dalgo, signing on behalf of the army, and they're saying, we wish that this will not take place, because he became the symbol of the oppression and the, and you know, the all the killings that happened during this time, and people are remembering all the things that and the atrocities that he committed in Darfur, and this is a really bad thing.
That was Omar Ismail, senior advisor at the Washington-based Enough Project. He was speaking to my colleague Ayen Dengbior here in Washington. 7 people, including a UN peacekeeper from Ethiopia, were killed in Abyei yesterday when unknown gunmen attacked a local market. The chief administrator of the disputed Abyei region says 5 other people were wounded in the attack. Manyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Speaking by phone from Abyei, Kuala Lor Jok, the chief administrator of the disputed region, says people were going about their businesses, buying and selling, in a local Abyei market when gunmen suddenly began spraying bullets across unarmed civilians.
Unknown groups have attacked the Abyei market, killing 6 people plus the UN peacekeeper, making them 7. And now we are trying actually to investigate and to know exactly which group are behind the attack. And I'm sure they will be able to know exactly who are behind the attack. Yeah.
Kual says 5 civilians who were injured in the attack are receiving treatment at a medical facility run by the United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei, or UNESFA. He says the bloodshed occurred in a place where Misiria Arab nomads and the Ngok Dinka tribes would work together to supply food to the communities.
That market is a lifeline for the supply of food to areas of northern Bangladesh, as well as Wells and Torrens, and also the southern leagues and the areas of southern leagues and Gurin. This market has been established. It's an agreement between the two communal, the Mwanga communal and the Misiria communal. These are the people who have agreed and they established this market. And the market has been helping in supplying the most of the areas with food supply. And as the incident has happened, maybe the market may stop for some time.
The disputed area between Sudan and South Sudan was demilitarized by Khartoum and Juba in 2011, leaving the full responsibility of securing the area to the United Nations Interim Security for Abyei. A press statement issued by UNESFA today says the attack targeted UN peacekeepers. General Mehaore Zewde, the acting head of UNESFA forces, says the forces were providing security in the market when the gunmen opened fire. He says one Ethiopian soldier was killed and other peacekeepers were critically injured. Zewde is urging all communities in Abyei to respect the arms-free status of the area. Mawian Akola Arik, spokesperson for South Sudan Foreign Affairs Ministry, condemned the attack.
We are still looking into details of the incident. You know, Abyei is under control of the UNESCO forces who are keeping the security. And any incidents such as this, goes back to the forces that are supposed to be the ones keeping people safe.
In 2017, an attack carried out by unknown gunmen killed 2 people and wounded scores of others in the same area. The oil-rich region of Abyei was supposed to hold a referendum in 2011 under which local residents would declare which country they wanted to be part of, but the governments in South Sudan and Sudan could not agree on who was eligible to vote in the referendum. For VOA News, I am Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, many civilians in Juba say they cannot afford to send their kids to school. We'll tell you why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is it okay to tell a small white lie? to get out of trouble?
No. Because whether it's a white lie, a big lie, a small lie, it's the same thing. It's a lie. By the time it comes up worse than the way it would have been in the actual sense. So you better tell the truth in the first place and you get over it.
Yes, it's okay. Because the world we live in, sometimes you really need to do some small. Thank God you even said small. You do some small lies to get out of trouble.
Yeah, in my opinion, sometimes to tell a white lie is okay because some people cannot understand person easily. Unless you have to tell just something to take you out of them, then later on you will come and clarify it to them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA. South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Some civil servants in Juba say it's becoming increasingly difficult to keep their children in school since the government has failed to pay civil servants on time. Some students have started working to try to raise money to pay their school fees and buy uniform. Viola Elias has more for VOA from Juba.
17-year-old Isaac Kamule looks sleep-deprived as he sits at the phone-charging kiosk in Munukisuk Libya Market. Isaac, a primary aid student in Munuki East Primary School, says he was sent away from school because he has no school uniform or proper school bag. The kiosk owner, a neighbor of Isaac, pays him about 300 South Sudanese pounds a day. Isaac says he works 6 days a week at the kiosk so he can try to earn enough money to pay his school fees, buy a uniform and return to school before the start of examinations in September.
No, it's now about 6 months my parents haven't received any salaries. At home, we just look for any way to find money and do other businesses, small businesses. I think they cannot manage because also people need food at home and then other things, other materials at home.
A 23-year-old student of Juba Day Secondary School who prefers to speak on condition of anonymity to protect the identity of his parents who are civil servants says he has not been able to resume studies since the start of this year because his parents could not afford to pay his tuition fees.
I could not resume, you know, studies because I did not pay the tuition fee. My dad is running up and down, trying to borrow money for my case. Well, I would like to say, try to give the civil servants some salaries at least for 3 months, so that they're able to cope up or to pay other necessary things. Especially education for the students like us, so that we're able to continue with our studies.
Angres Bangu, a mother of five who also looks after three orphans, says it is impossible to pay the tuition fees of all the children under her care. Speaking in Arabic, Bangu says she bakes and sells cookies and pancakes to raise money for her children's school fees.
This life is really very hard, but we are just surviving. If we get something small for food to eat, even me, if I see there is nothing at all, I usually help.
Speaking in Arabic, Juba parent Salma Emmanuel says her husband, a civil servant, has not been paid in 5 or 6 months, so they cannot pay the tuition fees of their three children.
A majority are now at home because of delay in their parents' salaries. If the parents are not paid their salary for the past month, how can they send their children to school?
Last month, South Sudanese lawmakers blocked the country's finance minister, Salvatore Garang, from presenting the proposed 2019-2020 fiscal year budget in protest over the government failure to pay the salaries of civil servants and security forces for several months. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
Still on school matters, civil society groups are urging young people to return to schools in Cameroon's volatile English-speaking region. Most schools in the region have closed down due to attacks and kidnapping stemming from the war between separatists and the military. The activists say children have a right to education, but not everyone thinks the schools are safe. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Menji in southwest Cameroon.
Civil society groups are here at the Menji Market Square, pleading with parents to send their children back to school and for young separatist fighters to resume their education. Donatus Nembo works for the education department of the Catholic Church.
We have come with a message of peace so that our children could go back to school. To those, our children, who are still holding arms, we are begging, really begging them to lay down their arms, join us in good faith. They should trust us because with us they can be reintegrated into life so that together we continue to rebuild our division which has been rendered backward.
16-year-old Nicolene Asheri says she is anxious to go back to school.
Yes, I really want to go back to school. I cannot sit for years without schooling. It's not normal. Seriously, so that we can go back to school because children that are growing and some of them, they will never go back to school. Some of them that are already pregnant, some of them have gone astray now.
Asheri has not been in school for 2 years since she and 90 other students were kidnapped from a college in the northwestern town of Kumbu and released after 2 days. The fighters had warned school authorities to stop all academic activity. Teacher Mercy Berry says she is not ready to return to her high school because she does not feel safe.
I was kidnapped. My principal was kidnapped. How do you expect me to go back? I don't know whether if I go back, they'll kidnap me or what. Schools have been burnt. They have not done any reconstruction. Where are we going to be teaching the children? How are we going to teach them? Where? In space? Outside? How are the children? How are they going to be secured?
An estimated 80% of the schools in the northwest and southwest have been closed since separatists began their uprising in 2017, citing the alleged overbearing use of French in the African country. The back-to-school campaign is carried out by associations of traditional rulers, clergy, parents and members of Cameroon's National Assembly. The only schools that have remained opened are in big towns like Bamenda, capital of the Northwest Region, and Boya, capital of the Southwest Region, where there is relative calm. Cameroon's Minister of Secondary Education, Nalova Lyonga, says children and teachers who want to brave the crisis and go to schools in their villages are patriotic Cameroonians.
It takes a lot of courage to really get up and say, I'm going to school at this time. That's why I am here, to say that you have carried the sacrifice so far. Carry it to the end. These are people who have sacrificed a lot.
The government says at least 130 schools have been burned by separatist fighters. But on social media, the separatists say the destruction is done by the military when they suspect the fighters are using schools as a hiding place. The military has denied the accusation. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Menji, Southwest Cameroon.
The British Broadcasting Corporation, also known as BBC, says it will close its bureau in Burundi after failing to convince authorities to lift a suspension imposed 14 months ago. Media advocates say the move is another sign that press freedom has disappeared in the Great Lakes country. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Media advocacy group Reporters Without Borders says it is extremely concerned about the fate of press freedom in Burundi as the British Broadcasting Corporation shuts its offices in the country. The BBC decided to pull out of Burundi after failing to convince the authorities to end a suspension imposed in May 2018. Burundi suspended VOA's operating license at the same time. The head of Reporters Without Borders Africa Desk, Anand Froja, says the closure cast a pall over the upcoming elections in Burundi. It is the death of a contradictory debate, and it is the promise of credible elections, because no dissident voice, no critical voice, no independent will be allowed during the electoral process. He says all kinds of independent journalism are threatened in Burundi. It is the survival of independent journalism which is in play here. Last week, media regulatory body CNC shut down Iwachu, a weekly newspaper, because of alleged bias and defamation. A journalist working for Iwachu has been missing since July 2016. In June, CNC also threatened Radio France International with sanctions for speaking to Burundi's rights activists. Lewis Marge is the Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch.
This is very unfortunate. We should remind listeners that Burundi, just a few years ago, was once considered to be really almost the benchmark of media in a post-conflict society in the region. Now that's completely changed. The media is now in a situation where they are on the back foot, they are on the defensive, and they are persecuted. Anyone who considers themselves to be a free and fair journalist who's seeking to do their job in Burundi now is in reality under serious threat.
Most journalists have fled the country over the years for fear of attacks. Human rights organizations have accused authorities and the youth wing of the ruling party, known as Imbonerakure, of committing widespread abuses against perceived opponents. Burundi has been in a state of turmoil since 2015, when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for what critics said was an unconstitutional third term. Nearly 350,000 Burundians have left the country. Nitigeka Shirik is a lawyer representing Burundi political victims. He says the ruling party CNDD-FDD has taken over the country and is abusing anyone who opposes their rule.
The main issue now is that all institutions in Burundi are serving the interest of the ruling party. Particularly feel bad when I see what the judiciary is doing now, because people are being killed by security forces. There are also hate speech that is heard sometimes before judicial officers, and nothing is done to hold those people accountable.
Burundi, a country of about 10 million, is expected to hold its elections in May of next year. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We'll now leave you with the song and a guide by Crazy Fox. We have been listening to Crazy Fox with the song Ana Mamashi and a Guide. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you inviting us into your vehicles and homes. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Me no have no same place to run. One man folks no have no place to go on. Me have to die and you know what I want. If you give me faith in life in my land, me shot I could have filled up a man like a fan. Someone please come give me a helping hand. If you this job could have get me by me yard. Big up to all them patches them day. Master man salute all the army them day. Lil J, me be there rest in peace. Aye, 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 aye.